At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to episode 207 of What Most People Think. And I know that I'm really pushing my luck with the cricket here, but I'm recording this on the Monday after England won on Sunday. And how about those England lads, eh? We won it hard but fair. We played hard but fair. I will be talking about the cricket more in a minute. I'm aware that I have to ration it because I just can't afford to lose listeners. I hope you're good. I hope you've been having a good weekend. I'm being positive here. And there's a new, I don't know if you've heard, but there's a new alternative to Twitter called Threads. I mean, it's just the biggest ripoff in the world. You know what I mean? They call it Threads. Like, they've just ripped off the fucking layout, everything. Someone's going to get sued, but I'm here for it in the meantime. It should be a laugh. I mean, it's almost like if you was to do, you know, you got Instagram. It's almost like if you was to do another photo website called Immedi Photo. You go, Immedi, that's just, no, it's completely different. It's completely, Immedi Photo. You've literally got a fucking picture of a camera. It's the same colours. But the thing with this Threads thing is where Twitter has got a reputation for being toxic. It's so toxic, you know, which all depends on how seriously you decide to take people just writing, anonymous people writing stupid shit. But I found the Threads thing. I have joined it. So if you don't do Twitter and you want a Twitter type thing, then you could go to Instagram and find my Threads account. Fuck. I mean, I'll be honest, I hope it fails. I do hope it fails because it's just more places you have to post fucking stuff. It's a pain in the ass. So I hope it fails, but I can't afford to not be on side if it does take off. And it's so positive over there. It's really weird. Like, it made me realise that maybe Twitter isn't so bad because you've got all these pricks on Threads going, hi guys, how's everyone doing this morning? You know, basically that's a public figure who's got fuck all to say. How are we this morning, peeps? How's it going, peep tweeps? So I want everybody to tell me, what's your favourite kind of granola? I'm like, my God, is this what Threads is going to be? Is it going to be like the equivalent of sort of FM radio in the early 90s? You remember when Smashy and Nicey, hey everybody, how's it going? I hope you're having a tip-top morning. God, hello mate. So I don't like Threads. I'm just going to slag it off the whole time I'm there. I'm going to be negative when I'm there. You know, because as I said in one of my first Threads posts, is that no comedian has ever got a laugh out of telling you how onside they were with something. You know, no comedian has ever said, oh, have you ever noticed airports and airline food? I really like them. You know what I mean? Like, that is not the basis of humour. So let's see how it goes. This is What Most People Think. This is the podcast, the topical and discussion podcast that comes from slightly to the right of centre, mostly on political and social issues. But this week, every so often, I like to go back the other way, you know, go across the political divide and speak to somebody with a very different political view. We had Owen Jones in the past. We've had various left-wing people. And Aaron Bastani, the luxury communist himself. Now, he has been, you know, I wouldn't say controversial figure, but he's had his battles with all sides of the political divide. But I was always interested with those guys like Owen and Ash Sarkar. You know, they were a genuinely new wave of political sort of commentary out that came about with Corbyn and stuff. And I just think he's sort of, as he says in the interview, you know, he's matured himself and he finds himself as an interesting critic of where Labour are at, right? And as I tried to put an analogy to him as to why maybe the left are the best critics of the left. So I think you'll enjoy it. And I think that there's a lot, you know, Starmer almost certainly is going to be our next Prime Minister at this stage. And I think that there's a lot to get your teeth into there. You know, it's rare that you have such a clear view this far out of who the next leader is going to be. So why not start holding them to account now? Do you know what I mean? Let little Rishi have some fun, right? He's just making memories, little Rishi. These all meeting Biden. It's just stuff for his scrapbook, isn't it? Only one of them is going to remember that meeting. Okay, new patrons. I've got to say to the Patreon community, stand by your beds, listen up and listen good, because there is something in the works, man. There's something coming up. It's not going to be in the next week or even 2 weeks, but I'm working on something. And I've always wanted to find a way of improving the offer to the people who've supported this podcast right from, you know, the moment we went into lockdown, to make it like better. I'm aware that a lot of it is by your good grace. Of course you get your name shouted out. Of course you get immediate access to free stand-up specials. Of course you get your Patreon-only episode every month. But I want something for it that every week you're getting a benefit from being a patron. So to make sure that you stick around for the next couple of months, because there's things in the works. Okay, our new patrons, on that note, we've got Alex Yudin. Alex Yudin. That does sound like a Russian name. Is it Russian? Alex Yudin. Maybe you're like a spy and you forgot to, like, you made one part of your name, like, inconspicuous, but didn't do the other. Like, your name's Yevgeny Yudin, and you put Alex Yudin. Oh shit, fuck. Alex Yudin. Maybe for the Russians, you're in charge of keeping an eye on podcasts. Make sure they're not, you know, getting out of hand with the built-in jokes. Frederick Payne. I mean, you just get to be called Mr. Payne. I'm sure that is intriguing when you're on a dating website. Is that a reputation, or is it emotional or physical pain? Good pain or bad pain? Mr. Payne. Frederick Payne. Good to have you on board, Frederick. Matthew Wright, who I think is one of those people that gets bumped out routinely by Patreon. And then Kevin Greenhalla. So Kevin, I said his name last week. He also got bumped out, but I thought I'd try his name again. We're now on a fourth attempt to say Kevin's name. Kevin Greenhig. Whatever, man. Like, just fucking change the way that your name's spelt. Just change your name. If you want your name to be read out correctly, then change it to a phonetic spelling and stop being a tart. Okay, the main talking point. We had a couple of actually emails just before we get to David Domain, our super patron, who's been with us right since the beginning and gives feedback on the previous week's podcast. And last week was a solo episode, I think, reacting to stuff in Paris and the cricket, which would still be a good listen. I mean, that was arrogant. It's only me speaking on it. But, you know, I like talking. What can I say? So we got letters. One of the things I brought up in that podcast was about sporting teams that are not associated with good, like, impressive animals. I can't remember what the jumping off point was. But, you know, like, for example, if you're called the Worcester Weasels, you know what I mean? Like that, you generally want to be like, oh, that's Miami Dolphins, I was saying. Miami Dolphins, great team. People like Miami, they like Dolphins. So a lot of people emailed in to tell me about their sporting clubs that don't have impressive animals. A guy called Jack says that his local rugby club is called Chicken Rugby Club. Chicken. That's just weird. Chicken Rugby. I mean, it'd be like, if you were sponsored by something to do with chicken, like, you know what I mean? Like one of those shitty local KFC ripoffs, like Just Chicken or Just for Chicken Rugby Club or Chicken Tonight Rugby Club, but Chicken Rugby Club. Jack, who is a Palace fan, I'm guessing, nominates the Seagulls, Brighton and Hove Albion, the Seagulls, because they don't think, oh, right, because Palace are called Eagles and Brighton are called Seagulls. I mean, has there ever been a more tenuous basis for a rivalry in football than that? I mean, some of them in football are just so fucking weird. Like, for example, well, I mean, just to finish this one off, Eagles and Seagulls, I mean, what, you're different kinds of birds. And they go, no, it's not just that, Jeff. We're joined by the M23 motorway. I mean, that is not a basis for a fucking rivalry. You know, you want some proper sectarian stuff. Religious and a history of religious and racial intolerance. That's what a proper sporting rivalry is. Rangers and Celtic, or like Newcastle and Sunderland, some old fucking union dispute, apparently. But, oh, you're linked by a road and a similar type of flying bird. Fucking get over it. So David Domain says, he in response to last week's show, he said, your French gig story made me chuckle. So I was telling the story about, I was gigging in Paris at the beginning of the year, and one of the other comics sort of apologised for what a bin fire Britain is, and all the French people, they didn't really respond. And then I spoke to a French person afterwards, and they said, well, you know, things aren't so good here either, you know. And but in a French accent, he said it, unlike me. So David says, according to the Global Peace Index, the UK is ranked at 37th most peaceful sovereign state in the world. You think, oh, 37, you know, it's not top 10. That's not what they are, but roughly 170 countries or something. That's, you know, I mean, that is, you're in the Champions League spots of safety, maybe European conference later, the one, West Ham one. But here's the context. So we're at 37th. France is 67th. Okay, so in assessing peacefulness, the GPI panel consider crime rates, terrorist acts and violent demonstrations, relations with neighbouring countries, political scene stability and whether small population proportion of the population are internally displaced or refugees. So overall, France is coming in 67th. So, you know what I mean? They say call it Gay Paris. You know, maybe we should start calling it Gay, you know, Peterborough. That doesn't even make sense. Okay, let's do a quick thank you and a fuck you. So I want to say thank you, of course, to the England cricket team. 2-0 down in the Ashes. If Australia had won at Headingley, that would have been 3-0. There would have been two more games, but they're completely dead rubbers. Australia win their first series in England since 2001, and the dream is dead, effectively. You know, the clash of, you know, England playing exciting cricket and Australia just, you know. Hard but fair, mate. Hard. Fear. But in fairness to Australia in this match, they did play a bit of baseball themselves. Some very excited stuff from Mitchell Marsh and Travis Head. But England got over the line. And I got up in the morning. So I was working that evening. And I had to stop at a service station because listening to it on the radio, I thought was a genuine driving hazard. And after England won, I rang my wife. And I've got to be honest, I didn't fully cry. But my voice broke a little bit. I rang my wife to relay the news. And I said something like, England won, babe. The voice, England won, babe. England won. And she said it was fine, but I think I lost a bit of respect there. But I was so excited. I wanted my son to know. And because it was too late for me and him to watch it in the evening. So I got him up on Monday morning at 7 a.m. early to watch the highlights. He's going to hate it, isn't he? He's going to hate cricket. He'll just remember somebody forcing him to do something. And I said to my wife, you know, I did that because I just wanted him to know what everyone's talking about at school. And she just took me by the hand and said, Jeff, no one's going to be talking about this at school, okay? Some people love cricket. Most people just don't. And that's true. She doesn't hate cricket herself. She was just being realistic. The fuck you to Sadiq Khan. And Transport for London. So there was an advert on the tube for a play. It's about a wedding and it had a wedding cake in the poster. And of course, Transport for London can't possibly have a picture of a cake, which is obviously to do with a wedding because it's a wedding cake. Because a cake is a very high sugar food, right? So they removed that. They would fearlessly remove that. And, you know, hey, Sadiq Khan's London. We can't stop teenagers getting stabbed, but we can stop them seeing jam and Victoria Sponge. I mean, has Sadiq Khan ever done anything which hasn't either cost Londoners money or been some flag-waving moral stance? And what kind of precedent does this set by Sadiq, whereby you're going, all right, we can't have any posters for things with high-calorie content. What about like films like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs? You go, well, that's fucking red meat. Red meat, a lot of fat to bind that mince, I tell you. The film Grease, I mean, that's just unadulterated lard, you know, fried green tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. It never ends. But Sadiq will obviously win again because Londoners, they like to think that they're evolved voters and they hate everything Trumpian, but they don't realise that Sadiq is basically, you know, he makes big statements that one group of the population will love and one will hate, and that is the way that he gets elected. Okay, time for the chat of Aaron Bastani. Now, like I say, always interesting to speak to people coming at things from different angles. And I think Aaron here, you know, we disagree on some stuff, we agree on some stuff, but he does offer some unique insights. And there's a surprise take on Nigel Farage. Right, I'm delighted to say, making his debut on What Most People Think, is Aaron Bastani. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
Well, mate, it's good to have you here because I've got this, I've always loved the word centrist dad. Now, I think I first saw that on your Twitter feed. So can you confirm for us exclusively in those heady early Corbyn days, did you make up that word or were you just part of bringing it to the masses?
I don't think I was. I think it was probably Matt Zarb who coined it. You know, he's mm-hmm. he coined lots of words, you know, like the melts. I mean, obviously, again, that's a widely used term, but the way it entered a sort of political lexicon, I think that was Matt Zarb, the centrist dads. And then it took on a power of its own, didn't it? And now people are still using it. Corbyn's no longer the leader of the Labour Party, but it's still out there. It's still part of our political idiom. So obviously, well, Matt touched on something.
Well, I mean, it's sort of almost more relevant today than ever, really, because I suppose it, in a way, is the centrist dads who've sort of got the levers of power. But in your mind, what? Because by the way, I see myself as sort of like a right of centre centrist dad. I'm not excluding myself from this category in any way. But what are the things that make up a centrist dad?
Well, I would sort of actually push back against the word itself. So I don't think the centre exists. I don't think it exists in the way that we mm-hmm. use it in political language. Now, I think when people say I'm a centrist, at normal people, they mean to say I have quite moderate opinions. I don't have extreme views. I'm willing to compromise. These are all good things, by the way. I'm willing to compromise. You know, I'm willing to borrow ideas from left or right. Let's be pragmatic. When politicians say the center, or when political journalists say the center, what they seem to mean is actually a host of quite unpopular policies. So, for instance, the centre in this country, if you look at migration, law and order, is to the right of the Conservative Party, right? Mm-hmm. I don't agree with all of that, but that's just where we are. And then if you look at things like public ownership, particularly on things like water and rail, well, to the left of the Labour Party. So if you were talking about a genuine centre, ergo trying to represent mainstream opinion, it would look nothing like the officially sanctioned quote unquote center that you see in a lot of political conversation. So I think there's two points here. So there's elite uses of the word center, and then I think there's how regular people use the word center. And so I suppose when you say you're a center right centrist dad, I know you mean that second bit. And the interesting thing with that phrase for me is that there's this ambiguity where I think some people think, well, I'm being pragmatic, I'm seeking compromise. Actually, what you're talking about is you believe in a series from immigration to public services to law and order. You believe in a series of quite unpopular policies. So that's why I think this word centrist is really interesting, because it's so ambiguous.
I think you make a good point, you know, that there's almost like a political version of the word and a cultural one. Yeah. Just in terms of the culture one, let's think about the sort of piss-takey element of it. I mean, I'd imagine a lot of the centrist dads would have been watching Blur at the weekend. I mean, what are the habitual nature, if we were sort of like an Attenborough type thing, I mean, I guess like me, they're probably going to read the Times. They're probably going to, which kind of celebrities they're going to like? I mean, is there a sort of cultural character of the centrist dad?
Oh, for sure, Jeff. So in my mind, you know, you're wearing Superdry. You might have a Brompton bike. You might not. I mean, that's more the sort of London element, but you might have a Brompton bike. You're environmentally friendly and conscious, but you won't have an electric vehicle. It'll probably be hybrid. And if you haven't...
too far to have full electric.
Well, quite. Yeah. And if you have an SUV, you know, it'll be one of those sort of fake SUV hatchbacks. It won't be the full Monty sort of, you know, Land Rover. So you'd have one of those sort of fake SUVs, which is a bit like a hatchback rather than, you know, go the full Monty with a...
Would it be a pizza oven in the garden, perhaps? Is that...
Oh, my God, absolutely. You've nailed it, Jeff. Uni pizza oven. What else? You know, and then there's some interesting overlaps with, you know, millennial sort of culture. So I suppose it's probably more likely to wear North Face, Patagonia, right, Chile.
So this is useful. In a kind of nature documentary, we've described the centrist dad. Weirdly, there's not a phrase centrist mum. Women do get off very lightly in these pejorative words. If you think about words like dad bod, dad dancing, there's no mum bod. I mean, you just wouldn't fucking say that to a woman, though. You've got a mum bod. They'd be like, what the fuck you mean? And then a centrist mum, even though, you know, if you think about Middle England and who generally pitches to women in elections, you know, those are... John Major did very well with women in the 1992 election. So I guess those would have been centrist mums. Is there such a thing?
Yeah, it's such a good point. I guess electorally they matter more. But in terms of our political culture, the, you know, people who are the the columnists, the pundits on TV. I mean, perhaps they're just more likely to be men. I mean, I don't know, but you're right. That's a really, really good point. I suppose, like when you get the think tankers and the pollsters, they talk about Worcester woman, and so it's become a bit more, obvious. But that's a good point.
Worcester woman working to man, sort of like Gavin and Stacey, but for politics. I mean, you are how old are you now, Aaron?
39, old man now.
39. So it's interesting because, like, you were part of the sort of activist group around Corbyn. I'm sure that was, you know, you've been working for a long time before that, but you came to prominence. There was a generation of you, of Ash Sarkar and Owen Jones and stuff, and it was the first time a lot of people were hearing what they would have deemed to be hard left. Maybe that wouldn't seem like that to you, but in mainstream media outlets. I mean, now you're 39. Is are there a group of young, like, harder left guys beneath you that go, fucking Bastani, fucking centrist?
Of course. Yeah, of course. It's a funny one because obviously as you get older, you do become more restrained, more calm. Of course you do. That's just life. Mm. And it is interesting to see as you get older. I'm as left-wing as I've ever been. I'm probably more left-wing. But I you become more sort of ameliorative, and you don't seek out confrontation as you get older, right? Necessarily. Unless you might really believe in something. But, you know, as you get older, you develop this capacity where you can disagree with somebody rather, and you just think, you know what, I'm just not going to say anything. And obviously you have that all the time. But I think as you get older, it becomes sort of more the default setting. But with the younger people, you know, in a way it's good. I think it's really important for young people to have something to rebel against. So when, like, you get people who are like 22, they go, oh, you know, Navarra's crap, Bastani's, he's a right winger. Fine, you know, let them.
Did you get called that? I mean,
that's
hilarious. I mean, if you just hang around long enough, people will just get bored of thinking you're one thing and accuse you of another. I mean, you literally, what was the name of your book? Was it Luxury Communism?
Fully Automated Luxury Communism.
Yeah, but that wasn't enough to get you off the hook for being called a right winger.
No. Well, because you know, you might, I mean, Jeff, you said you're centre right. I'm sure you've got some, you know, quite left-wing opinions on something. I don't know what they would be. Mm. And so I suppose for you, it'd be similar, right? You might have a fellow traveller who's on the centre right. Oh, Jeff Norcott, he said this about this. He's a socialist. So, you know, and again, that, I think social media exacerbates all of that, doesn't it? It doesn't really allow nuance.
I've noticed that you've been reaching out across the divide more, having chats with people like Matt Goodwin and stuff like that. Is that who would be, I guess, how would you describe him, I suppose, to people that know who he is? He puts an articulated view of what would be called populism, I suppose, right? If that would be a fair, but you know, you treat him with respect and have those chats. Is that part of a change that's happened in you, where you just want to be talking to more people, essentially?
Well, I always think I've treated people with respect, actually. And I've always found that my mum was a conservative. So this idea that, you know, she was, I wouldn't call her a Thatcherite, because, you know, what does that really mean in 2023? But she voted Margaret Thatcher several times because she was a working class woman and she bought into that aspirational message. And what's weird is that she didn't get on the hatch. It's not like she benefited from Right to Buy. She was renting until 2005, you know, she got one of these subprime mortgages with Northern Rock, but she was really into that. So for me, it's you know, I don't view it as, you know, personal. Obviously I can view it as personal if somebody's being personally nasty, but just because somebody has a different political view or outlook, you know, I've said it before, I try and seek converts, not look for traitors. And so I think I've always been like that. I think
that's an interesting phrase. If I could just pick that up. I've never heard that phrase before. Converts, not traitors. Has that been a problem on the hard left, perhaps? Is that there is a sense of moral certainty that goes with it, that perhaps the ideological zeal can seek you to can cause you to seek traitors?
I think most once you get, you know, familiar with politics, you realize actually how, you said about, you know, the zealotry and so on. I mean, that's pervasive in all politics, really. Goes back to the point about centrist. I mean, my goodness, I think the most zealous people I've met in politics actually are quote unquote liberal centrists. So this idea that, you know, this kind of fanaticism where, you know, you don't want to even discuss things that people disagree with. I don't think that's worst of all on the left. I just don't. My experience actually is, you know, I've met some people who are sort of, you know, these quote unquote centrists in the media. And they'll say, oh, wow, you're so much nicer than you are online. And I say, well, I don't judge somebody from Twitter. That's just daft. Why would you judge somebody from behind a screen? It's ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. And then I'll meet people who I think, you know, quite nice online. I think, oh, this person's a bit strange. And vice versa, somebody who might seem a bit, you know, a bit out there, a bit nasty, is actually perfectly affable. So I think it's a good rule of thumb. Just don't judge somebody from their conduct on Twitter, unless, of course, you know, it's just, you know, completely outrageous.
You were obviously part of the group around Corbyn, and that was a different place, wasn't it? Because you were trying, that was a radical agenda. Certainly, I mean, a lot of what he was saying then doesn't seem as radical now, but then it was a very radical proposition. And you were fighting, I guess, two kinds of establishments, really, was the sort of like right-wing media and the sort of right of the Labour Party. What I've noticed recently, and part of the reason I was keen to have you on the show, is obviously you guys, you know, on the left are critiquing, you know, the centre of the Labour Party now. And I feel like sometimes your analysis and commentary is the best, because you grew up together, if you know what I mean. It's like getting the gossip from a sibling, if you know what I mean. I found that basically, I suppose the question I'm asking is what's it been like having that shift whereby you've gone from trying to get, you know, a properly left-wing Labour Party elected to trying to critique a very centrist Labour Party to have traditional Labour policies?
Well, the thing is, again, it goes back to that point about the centre. And I love that idea of a sibling having the best gossip. It's probably, it's a really good way of looking at it. You know, we can say it's a centrist Labour Party. Again, that means a multitude of things, doesn't it? Because I totally understand why Keir Starmer has to appeal to Labour Tory swing voters in the Red Wall. I totally get it. He has to do that. If you want to win, that's what you have to do. I'm not averse to that in the slightest. What I don't like is the fact that Labour will constantly misrepresent what are very popular policies as being unpopular. So, for instance, on water ownership, ownership of rail, energy. Now, I'm not expecting them to say, we're going to nationalise all of these things. But what you should be able to do is you need to create some of the mood music and say, look, when it comes to trains, the private sector hasn't been ideal. You know, we, you know, and talk about it more, because I actually think there's a strong chance. For instance, there's a strong chance the Labour government will bring rail back into public ownership. It's one of those things they promised, but I think it's probably the one thing they'll deliver on. But if you do that without setting out why to the public for months or even years beforehand, I just don't see how that's going to work, because the first year that those trains are in public ownership and you increase tickets by 6 or 7%. You know, which you have to do to provide a better service or whatever, you're going to get absolutely hammered. So you need to take the electorate and the population on a journey with you as to why this is a good idea and how fixing the problem, what it will look like. So yeah, that's, you know, I would say it's bad politics. Now, right now, Labour are 25 points ahead in the polls. So who am I to say bad politics? You know, Aaron, you idiot, you were supporting Jeremy Corbyn. But I think if you want to fix the problems in this country, it's going to be very, very difficult. And I think it's going to require, you know, they've got a lot of political capital right now, and I don't think they're using it as well as they could, because, you know, they're frankly not being honest with the electorate about the scale of some of the challenges we've got to face.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, you look at what Starmer's professed principles and political orientation was not that long ago. And then you just wonder, will he be like this in office? So he's sort of like, well, he's lying to someone. He either lied to become leader. I mean, he would say that it's evolved because of the financial challenges, which I think is fair on some level. But or he's going to, it's like a bait and switch. You know, it might be like, you know, those film trailers where they sort of insinuate a film's going to be completely one thing and it's not. I remember that Netflix did a reboot of He-Man recently, and this is a really weird analogy, but in the end, it was all about Teela. Look, I've got no issue with strong female role models, but if you're selling me a fucking He-Man reboot, then give me the He-Man reboot. And I think this is the thing with Starmer, is there'll come a point where he's going to disappoint somebody, right? And so I guess your point is that could happen quite quickly in office.
Well, you know, you had this thing from Wedge Streeting over the weekend, and he said, this is last weekend, and he said, you know, it's better for people, effectively he's saying, it's better for people to have no hope than false hope, which is a strange thing to say, which is ergo, Labour is not offering anybody any hope. I think that's right. And also I should add, I don't think Keir Starmer believes in anything. And when I say this on Twitter or I write about it, people think I'm being nasty or I'm trying to, you know, it's like a political attack. I believe it. I don't know what else I can say. I meant to make these observations. I believe it. You know, he had a year into his tenure as Labour leader, he was having, this is in the Times, Sunday Times, he was having private sessions with Charlie Faulkner, who's a Labour lord, Ned Miliband, which is basically a dummy's guide to economics and the economy. You know, I don't think he came to politics really late, which, you know, has
it was 2015, too. Right? He became an MP in 2015. And I do think it's kind of strange on aspects of the left whereby they sort of deem themselves to be progressive. But a lot of the reason that they think Starmer is the finished article is, let's be honest, because he's a straight white guy that speaks in a certain way and he's a sir. So they just imagine him to be a grown up in the room. Even, I mean, obviously he had his experience in the CPS, which he doesn't like to mention, you know, but yeah, you're right to mention he's quite green in terms of Westminster politics.
Totally. I mean, and also, I mean, it sounds, again, to sort of inside baseball people in Westminster, his voice is awful, right? That's the sort of thing. It's true.
I'm sorry, I will not have that. But, I mean, I'm no Matt Ford, but I'll give it a go.
People think, oh, you're being nasty or whatever. Guess what? Margaret Thatcher had the exact same problem. And, you know, she had a voice coach and, you know, she ended up having a really authoritative, you know, way of speaking. So, and that matters. If you want to recalibrate British politics, if you want to be a really popular politician, you can't talk like that. And I know that sounds mean or nasty or trivial. It is trivial. Some people are trivial. That's the problem. So, like, you know, there was a piece by Janan Ganesh in the FT about voice privilege. I thought it was great. It was a great article. I don't agree with much of what Nigel Farage says, but he has this deep baritone from smoking 40 Marlboro a day, you know, drinking.
Yeah, and a rhythm. There's just a way, well, a way that he'll talk and say, Aaron, I know that you will agree with me on this. And he'll get you. I mean, it happens with comedians as well, where I've often thought, like Mickey Flanagan, one of the great strengths he has is that I'm often thinking, I'm going to laugh at whatever the end of this sentence is, because there's something about the cadence of the way that you're getting there that's so persuasive. I mean, there is a thought that I had with Starmer is that he might be the most effective small C conservative in the country. And I think we're talking a couple of days after that he is allowed to be leaked, lo and behold, that he actually hates tree huggers. So there's this interesting quote, which is a bit Alan Partridge, that sort of goes, oh, can I surprise you? I actually hate tree huggers. and I just thought, I wonder if Starmer, there'll be a sort of beginning of him saying just a series of abstract small C conservative phrases like, you know, I blame the parents. You know, you can't get the staff these days. And what he's doing is bit by bit, I suppose the project is to just say, don't worry. I'm you can trust this guy because he thinks some fairly middle of the road stuff. But meanwhile, 2023, there's absolutely no chance that a Labour government would look at the drugs laws, which we should be ahead of that, right?
I think that's right. And it goes to the point of it's politics by press release and it's politics by optics, which is, again, it's no way to run a country. We've been running a country like that for a long time. And it means dysfunction. It means permanent dysfunction. I think you're right. And if you say small C conservative, I mean, I think most small C conservatives quite like the countryside. And, you know, they like the idea of nature and they like walking their dog. And, you know, that's a very, this is probably going to go down poorly with, you know, people who live in cities. That's a very non-metropolitan thing to do. You take your dog for a walk in a, you know, a forest or a wood or whatever. Or the beach. That's an experience that lots of people who don't live in cities share. So, like, I feel like, I think you're right. I think he is a small C conservative, by the way. But this whole doing politics by polling and press release, it gives you a big lead. And by the way, we don't know. I think Labour will win a big majority in the next election. But we don't know that yet. Things change really quickly. And, you know, I do question if it's for the right of the country. And that's why I support proportional representation. I think it would bring a bit more honesty into politics. I think you'd have, you'd have more overtly right-wing politicians. You just would. Farage would be very powerful. You'd have more overtly left-wing politicians. But then the electorate knows who they're voting for. They know where they stand. And they think, well, I'll vote for this person and they'll have to probably negotiate with this person or this person. We have that already inside the two big parties. It's just none of us know what's going on.
Well, it's funny because there was that period where Labour were a bit ahead, like enough ahead to be the biggest party. And there was a lot of talk of a progressive alliance, and which I always thought was I think the problem with it, Aaron, though, is it presumes that everybody would vote the same. I mean, a lot of the people that were tweeting about it seemed to presume that the way to get a left-wing government was by a progressive alliance. What it never took account of was how many people would think, well, I don't fucking want that, and then might vote in a more right-wing way. But I do sort of feel sorry for the Lib Dems in a way. Yet again, they were sort of led along. There was a lot of tweeting of progressive alliance. They were cultivated. Then the moment sort of Partygate happens, and then the Liz Truss thing happens, you barely see that word knocking about anymore, because the truth is, most people in the Labour Party, they've got no interest in that, have they? That, you know, they really want to hold power unrestrained.
Yeah, there's a few things there. So I don't believe in a progressive alliance under first past the post, or the tactical voting thing. I think you're right. But there are lots. Go to Somerset, go to the Southwest. There's lots of conservative Liberal Democrat voters. And so the idea that they would be part of a really broad left-wing alliance, they don't understand what you're talking about. They don't understand what you're talking about. Two of the heartlands of the Liberal Democrats in the last century, obviously the Liberal Democrats only exist more recently, but encompassing the Liberal Party previously too, two of their heartlands are the Scottish Highlands and the English Southwest. You couldn't get more conservative places. So this idea that they're all sort of left-wing is daft, frankly. And I suppose the Labour have a good point on this, which is, there is a progressive alliance. It's called the Labour Party because, you have first past the post and it has to be an umbrella for so many disparate views. I think that's not an unreasonable thing, but I just think if you look at first past the post of the system, I just don't think it works. Take the NHS. We have this bizarre situation now where it's a political football. The Tories do relative to Labour, I think this is inarguable, they underfund it. They fund it less than the Labour Party do. I know a tremendous amount of funding has gone into it in the last 3 years, but, big macro scale, they fund it less than Labour. Labour fund it to an extraordinary extent. So you get, Thatcher underfunds it, Blair and Brown overfund it or fund it sufficiently. Then we've had underfunding again. Now Labour is saying, well, we'll come in and we'll increase funding again. And so you're going from famine to feast, 0 to 10, on the NHS. And some people say, well, maybe we shouldn't have a health service which is so subject to political volatility, or we could just have proportional representation where you have a bit of stability. So you do create something and people broadly agree on it, whether that's the NHS or whether it's a mixed partnership system or whatever. But what we have here is, and going back to your point about drugs, Labour could decriminalise cannabis tomorrow and you might have a 10-year Labour government and it's really successful. The Tories come in, they reverse it.
What is the fear with drugs and legalisation? Because I've often speculated that the moment someone becomes prime minister, they don't want to be the one on the front page of the Sun, photoshopped with a spliff in their hands, basically, because that might be the way that the right wing press would go. Even if loads of journalists agree with it, the easiest angle of attack, right, is whoever's prime minister at the time that you legalise, is you make out they're a wacky backy, they're a dope fiend, and it's so weird because I've been talking about this on the Tories that. This is one area where the public are almost all ahead of the two main parties, right? In terms of liberality. So I'm not talking, honestly, I don't think you should legalize cocaine in this country. I just, for whatever reason, I don't think we're equipped to deal with that. But I think cannabis, I struggle to understand how in 2023, we're arguably further away than we felt in the late 90s. I find that bizarre.
Well, I think this was the remarkable thing about Brexit, and lots of people on the left or in the centre left can't accept it. Something happened. People did something.
Something radical happened, yeah.
Yeah, something happened. And the whole point of the two-party system in this country is don't do anything. Don't change anything. And again, it goes back to that point about centrism. That's one reading of it, moderation, compromise, all good things. Another reading of it is, when it comes to elite politics, is don't do anything. Don't solve any problems. Whatever you do, don't solve any problems. And we're looking at the political overhead of that, Jeff, which is 15 years of stagnant wages, not enough housing being built, 101 other things I could list. But one of them is, our drugs policy, which could be raising tax revenues, it could be saving the police time, and it could just be enhancing civil liberties. But we don't do it because the political elite, we can't do anything. And because they're terrified. They are terrified, like you say, I think, to an almost irrational extent now, of the right-wing press.
There is this feeling that Starmer has sort of pushed. I mean, I've said in the past, it's almost like he's trolling the left of the party. There's a difference between reorienting, but literally the only way. It was almost like the Tories in the middle of the 2010s with austerity. It became the most successful way of getting polling boosts. So He seems to go back to this well a lot. Is there a degree where he could alienate the left enough that it would have an electoral consequence? Or when it comes, when push comes to shove, will the opportunity to get the Tories out, that will that win the day? So even if Labour are fairly right wing?
Well, I think when you say the left, so I think you're talking about, I mean, the left is big, the radical left is big, but you're only realistically talking about max across the country, a couple of 100,000 people, like radical left, who really think about their politics,
yeah,
you know, political strategy, etc. Then, of course, around them, you have a much, you know, 10 million plus people who are very left wing, who either don't vote or vote Labour or vote Green or, you know, SNP or whatever. And I think the most part, those people, like you say, will, their priority is to get rid of the Tories. I think that's kind of indisputable. Where I do think Labour has an issue is one of the lessons I've taken from the last several years is don't make enemies in politics unnecessarily. If there's no upside, don't make an enemy of somebody. And I think Keir Starmer's doing that right now. And look, that there might not be a political overhead for 5 years, 10 years. I have no idea. But generally speaking, it tends to rear its head eventually. So I feel like what he's doing, I think that's, again, it's a very good analogy of the whole, you know, oh, we want a little bit of a polling boost, let's bash the left. That's fine when you're in opposition. Try doing it in government. It's not going to be very effective. Now, he's very lucky because the Tories are collapsing. And I wouldn't be surprised if in opposition, the Tories, you know, collapse even more. If you have a sort of repeat of what happens after 97, you know, it takes the Tories the best part of 8 years to really just get their act together. You know, and in an alternative universe, they would have done that in 8 months. And I think something similar will happen this time, although, you know, predictions mean nothing. So the trolling thing is concerning. Again, it goes back to the national interest. Like, okay, it's good for your polling numbers, but when you're trying to solve problems in government, how's that going to help anybody? Talking about Jeremy Corbyn, I find the whole thing so trivial and nutty, frankly. I find it nutty. We've got so many problems in this country, and yet the whole shadow front bench, the only thing they speak about with real passion is Jeremy Corbyn and somebody's post on Facebook. You know, it's really.
But is that a legacy of how they have felt that they were treated during that time? You know, that they
Keir Starmer was quick. Keir Starmer was treated quite nicely. He was made the Brexit secretary.
Well, I mean, yeah, but we all forget. Keir Starmer did some sort of Men in Black style mind wipe. You know, there was a point in time where his past seems to not have mattered. But I guess that they were. I'm just trying to sort of, you know, sort of play devil's advocate a bit. Well, not devil's advocate, but just see it how they would see it, which is that at that time they were made out to be not Labour or not left wing, or, you know, because they didn't fully subscribe to Corbyn's agenda. You must admit, I mean, there was a thing around Corbyn. I've never seen a political leader where people chanted their name. And there was a kind of baggage that went with that, that it was a bit, there was a zealotry about it in some quarters.
I honestly disagree. I think the zealotry, oh, well, I don't disagree with the first part. Obviously, the chanting happened. But I think if you're talking about zealotry, David Cameron, George Osborne, after 2010, that is zealotry. When, you know, your program of austerity has been so counterproductive in so many ways, you know.
But I mean, the cult of personality around the person. Times I've seen that in politics. I saw it up close to Nicola Sturgeon when I met her. Not necessarily from her, but just the sort of sycophancy around her. And, you know, I've been watching politics a long time. And then the moment you see a politician, I mean, look, historically, the moment people chant politicians' names, it does ring historically one or two alarm bells.
I mean, does it? I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's people, we live in a free society. People can do what they like. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there was, before Brexit, I remember, what was it called? The Brexit, there was some song. Do you remember this? There was the Brexit song. You know, whatever, people can do what they like, have a bit of fun. I mean, that doesn't bother me. And the idea that, oh, well, the left isolated, you know, mainstream Labour politicians, and now they're getting their own back. People like Yvette Cooper, Rachel Reeves, they were all offered positions in the cabinet. They didn't want to serve in the cabinet. They didn't want to serve in the cabinet, which is their right to do that. They're allowed to do that. But, you know, Keir Starmer was given a very, very, he was given arguably the third most powerful position in the party after leader and shadow chancellor. And by the way, I don't know if I can swear on this. Can I swear on this podcast? Yeah. Keir Starmer's positioning on Brexit fucked this country up significantly. And it was purely so he could become leader of the opposition in the long term. That's why he did it. And I still don't think Remainers get this, is that the reason why we're not in a customs union, the reasons why we didn't have some sort of moderately different things that they would have liked to see, is because Keir Starmer engaged in an all or nothing strategy because it was to his interest. And I find that remarkable that somebody can do that and then say, country before party. Your career came before the country. Shut up.
Okay, hope you're enjoying the chat with Aaron there. Just to quickly hype something, the book, okay? We're having meetings now. It's coming out in less than a couple of months now. Less than a couple of months. So please, 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 if you're not a Patreon or whatever, but if you think, I should just do something nice for Jeff Norcott, just go on either Amazon or Waterstones, wherever you get your books, and order the hardback copy of my book. That is, it's a beautiful thing. Why did I say it like a twat? That's not selling. It's a beautiful thing. I sound like fucking Swiss Tony. A book, guys, is in many ways like making love to a beautiful woman. You know, you've got to open it at the right time. You've got to, I don't know any metaphors, so you've got to feel your way to the, you've got to read the situation. I'm struggling here. Just please, but it looks great. The guys, the team have done loads of graphics for it and just laid it out so nicely, and it will either teach you a bit more about being a bloke yourself, or it'd be a good thing to buy for the bloke that you know. And if you buy the book, the hardback, obviously when I'm doing gigs, when I come out afterwards, if I see people with hardback copies of the book, I will sign your book. Okay, let's make that a guarantee now. I sound like one of those stupid American blokes on the advert. That's right, the Jeff Norcott hardback guarantee. If I see you with the book, I will sign that book. No exceptions. Can't think of the word exceptions there. All right, let's go back to the chat with Aaron. Do you think that there is a chance that the next election, I mean, I've been making this prediction for 3 years now, but there will be effectively a Jeremy Corbyn party. It might not be called that. Although JCP does sound pretty good. They probably make a song of it. Do you remember that song, My Dad Drives Me Around His JCB? It'd be this difficult second album syndrome. But, you know, I guess when you look at people like Diane Abbott, you look at like figures on the harder left. Is there a chance of that, or would he be aware of that would be perceived of sort of letting the Tories in the back door? I mean, is there enough time for an alternative, a genuine? I'm not just talking the Green parties. I'm talking a genuine left wing alternative.
So I have a line on this, which is there's a huge political space in Britain for a left wing party. If executed, it could do very well. It could drag public opinion in all sorts of interesting directions. The only problem is the left would be in charge. So, it's the political opportunities are there, the space is there, but frankly, I mean, there's just, and this isn't the criticism of Jeremy Corbyn, by the way. I think actually there's people who've made far bigger mistakes than him between 2015 and 2019. But it just, you don't have the personnel. And I think this goes back to like a historic aspect of it. So I look at people who are younger than me or people my age or even people slightly older. You meet the economists, you meet the bureaucrats, you meet the people that if you had to run a civil service, you think, okay, this person could do this or that or this or that. But there was this, and it's probably because the 90s, right, and the collapse of the Soviet Union and, you know, the collapse of the left, and lots of people, you know, a lot of people in New Labour were former Stalinists, forget socialists or whatever. So there's this weird lag, there's weird gap where you just don't have the personnel to execute a project where you're going to really run a party at a top-notch level, run a country. So I think maybe in 10, 15, 20 years, I think is a different proposition. But now, no. I mean, Diane Abbott's historical record speaks for itself, like not the first black MP, but first black female MP, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. First black MP for the Labour Party. There's some mixed heritage MPs who go back further, the Liberals and the Whigs and whatnot. But clearly a bit of a trailblazer, and I think she should be commended for that. But, you know, the political instincts of some people on the Labour left, particularly since 2019, I'll pull my punches. They leave something to be desired. And I'm not talking about Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, it's interesting you say about, what I get the sense in a weird way is, even if you might not have supported Brexit yourself, is that I suppose you might have had some empathy for the project of Brexit, which was to try to do something radical and to see, you know, what could happen when the establishment mobilise against something. Is that a fair comment, that there was a strange sort of a low level empathy, because, you know, you saw what Corbyn was a radical proposition, whatever you think about him, and so was Brexit, and both of those things were manoeuvred against. And by the way, I'm not in that sense talking about anti-Semitism. You know, that I don't think those were manoeuvres personally, but I mean, you know, the depths to which the right-wing press were willing to portray Corbyn.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, for instance, there was this thing recently of Farage and his, you know, debanking, right? And he's claiming that, oh, various banks aren't offering me banking products and so on and so forth. I take that really seriously. And I've got people saying, oh, that's Farage, it's good it happened, or he's making it up. And I say, well, actually, these things matter, because I've seen Farage is an anti-establishment politician. I don't agree with him on very much. He is, clearly. He's a very disruptive politician. And I've seen how the establishment behaves with political figures like that on the left. I've seen it. They don't play fair. They are very, very dirty. Now, that doesn't mean I care what happens to Nigel Farage. But the point is, if you allow a default setting where the establishment can do what they like to political elements, political actors, high-ranking politicians, intellectuals, whatever, they, you know, if they can somehow remove them or undermine them in sort of political discourse by fair means or foul, and they don't care what it is, I think that's a problem, actually. And so, like with Brexit, I voted Remain. I am very sympathetic to Brexit. I think the good thing with Brexit is politicians can no longer blame the EU. You know, it's fantastic. Great. For the first time in my lifetime, Tory politicians are being blamed for immigration, right? I mean, again, I'm not on the right. I'm not that. I think we should have a more generous asylum policy, and then you have a more rational conversation around quote unquote economic migration. But park that. Whatever I think is kind of irrelevant here. Because we've left the EU, Tories can't point at Brussels. They're the ones to blame. They're the ones that are accountable to the British electorate. I think that's fantastic. And what Brexit has done is it's exposed how useless large swathes of the political establishment are. That's what screwed the Tory party more than anything else. Is like there's now like this magnifying glass on our domestic political elite. And like we're all looking at it, left, right, center, whatever, and we're all going, oh. They just seem to.
I guess it comes down in a way to centrist dads and this idea of grown-ups in the room. Was for me that strategically they just played every hand quite badly. If the project was to get a, you know, once if you just accept that once the vote happened, you had to have some sort of Brexit, which I think would be insane to think otherwise, right? Yeah. So the fact that there was this huge stop Brexit, you know, second referendum thing, I found crazy. But they at every stage along that process, you know, both with the EU and what they gave Cameron to go back and try and parlay, you know, the immediate thought of what could happen after the vote, the where they sort of in my book I mentioned that it was almost like, you know, on those old 80s game shows where they gamble and go for the car. You know, so they've got like a, so the car was effectively revoke, you know, but you just looked, you thought it's not going to fucking happen. And so whatever they might have been right about the economic impacts of Brexit and a whole lot of stuff, but the strategy element around, you know, what kind of Brexit we had was an absolute fucking disaster from their point of view. I mean, some of them are smart enough to realize this, but I do think that some of them just walk around thinking grown-ups in the room, we'll clean up the mess, but they have their own version of mess.
I think that's totally right. I think, again, it's something that I've said before and it's maybe a bit unpopular. Smarter people who work in the academy, people who have to think for a living, often make more stupid decisions because they come at things with the default position of I'm right because I'm clever. And I think that was what you saw with the Remain stuff. I'm right and I'm clever. All these people I know are clever, and they are, you know, clever people. If you're an academic, of course you're a clever person, you know, in terms of like history or politics, whatever you teach, you know. And I think that's the problem, is that you come at it with a certain cognitive bias, which is, well, all the clever people think, you know, we have to overturn Brexit, so it must be the clever thing to do. No, it's not clever. If 400 constituencies vote leave, forget 52-48. If 400 constituencies vote leave, you're going to get smashed in a general election.
Out of what, 650 roughly? Yeah. Is that the amount of constituencies? Yeah. So getting on for two-thirds of constituencies. Yeah, no, it was always going to bite them on the arse. Just going back a bit to that general election in 2019, I mean, you were around the kind of Corbyn movement at that time. One of the biggest surprises I've ever had politically is the Labour campaign in 2017 was a great campaign, right? Won a lot of support. The policies were popular. Great slogan for the many. It all worked. 2019, it was a snap election was the fucking most obvious thing that was going to happen. And yet everyone seemed to be caught napping. And that campaign was dog shit, frankly. I mean, the slogan itself, I think, was "It's time for a change," which literally sounds like, you know, those afternoon adverts that Michael Parkinson does for changing your life insurance. It was literally on that level. And then they campaigned without gusto. I just find it really blows my mind as to why that campaign was so bad. Do you have any theories on that?
Well, 3 points. Firstly, horrible weather. And I think that was part of the Tory decision around it. So you're trying to get the vote out amongst young people, be optimistic, offer an alternative. Mm. It's easier to do that when the sun's shining. And you know, you're canvassing, and I saw
that does sound like the Aussies making a cricket excuse there.
No, I think a lot of
cloud cover.
No, I genuinely think that probably was 1%. You know, Labour got 32%. Mm. I genuinely think if you have that election in the summer, they get, and that sounds daft, but then the majority of 80 goes to, you know, 55 or whatever. And then, so let's get to the serious points, which is, I think that was one variable. Another variable was the Facebook algorithm had changed. Again, that's not going to change the outcome, but I think that was probably 1 or 2%. I'm going with the low-hanging fruit here before people think, you know, think I'm being daft.
Well, I mean, to be honest, that now, I like that one, because that sounds like the kind of excuse I would make for my follower numbers. I'm like, look, they don't favour me. It's not my kind of platform.
Well, there are articles, if you look at it, the most shared articles in the 2017, it feels like a different world now, Jeff. Mm. The most shared articles in 2017 were like Evolve Politics, The Canary, like it was non-legacy outlets. Yeah. 2019, you've gone back to a certain default. You just have. I mean, I know this because at Navarra Media, we have a Facebook page, you know. So I know how the algorithm changed. But on the big things, so I've given you two things which are like maybe like 1%, right? On the big things, Brexit Party, massive, obviously, because they're contesting seats where it matters for Labour, but not for the Tories. That's a really big thing. But then I think on the sort of big, if I'm sticking the knife in with Labour, the first was a recency bias. Well, we did it by the seat of our underpants in 2017. We can do it by the seat of our underpants in 2019. Like, no, you're going to need a plan. You're going to need a strategy. Mm. You know, you can pull that off once. To pull it off twice, absolutely no chance. And then I think, sadly, I do think a lot of people on the Labour left, they bought the Remainer Kool-Aid, which was the majority of the country wants to stop Brexit. The Tories won't go, you know, they won't call an election because the Brexit Party will run. There's so much chaos. Actually, leave seats, leave voters now would vote Remain. I think they bought a lot of the Kool-Aid. So they're like, we've had loads of sort of inertia in politics with Theresa May. And they're like, the next 2 years will look like the last 2 years. And you're completely right. Boris Johnson came in and what the hell are you talking about? No, we're going to have a general election. 400 seats voted leave. I'm very happy to have a general election. So that was the big thing for me. And I've seen people in Westminster, very clever people. They go to that place for 6 months and they, you know, and that's the thing I like about Dominic Cummings, is that he made an intentional effort to be his own person. Again, you don't have to agree with that. But if you're a left winger or if you're a Scottish nationalist or whatever, if you want to execute your political project, you're going to need somebody like that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was the big problem for Labour, is they bought a lot of sort of establishment Kool-Aid on Remain.
One last point here is just to end on a slightly frivolous note, is I was going to ask you, like, who's the hardest bastard in the Labour Party? Like, we often talk about hypothetical political fights here. Like, if it came down to a scrap in a pub car park, I've often thought, like, when I look at John McDonnell, and I know you've been around the man, he just gives me the willies. Like, he just looks like, his look is like a right hook. I mean, I'm talking about age adjusted here. So, you know, like when you fight on a PlayStation boxing game, they all take them back to their prime. I mean, if it absolutely came down to it, who would you want in your corner if it went off at a Wetherspoons?
Ian Lavery.
Ian Lavery?
No doubt about it. You know, Ian Lavery, he was on the miners' strike when he was a young man. He was like 18 or something.
Yeah.
Ian Lavery was one of the first people to be arrested on the miners' strike. He was arrested on the first day. He wasn't even a miner. He was like an apprentice or whatever. You know, he was nicked on the first day because he punched somebody. So I hope he doesn't
mind saying that. Those are good Labour credentials. I mean, that is, it's weird. I mean, you spoke about people's voices and the public. I mean, it's no surprise, and it's completely legitimate politically. The public respond to people, right? So they respond to your voice. And it was, if you look on paper before John Prescott punched that bloke in the face, right? If you said, what is the political out, you know, if you'd have offered that to Blair and Alistair Campbell at the time, said one of your top people could punch a member of the public in the face, they would mobilise everything to stop that happening, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
when it happened, it established him in the hearts and minds of the British public forever. So maybe that's Ian Lavery, you know, if it comes around, maybe that should be his pitch. When Labour win the election and after a year they junk Starmer because they want an actual left-wing thing, just if anybody can find video footage of Ian Lavery laying out somebody at a miners' strike, I think that could win it.
What most people think.
I mean, obviously, I say to people, you know, there might have been people that during the Brexit and the Corbyn years that looked at the Navarra and people like yourself and Ashley used to get wound up and stuff. I do think that you guys, in terms of analysis now, are in a really interesting position. And I think if Labour get in, you know, definitely people, it's worth, you know, checking out some of your stuff. Is there anything in particular you'd like to direct people to?
Oh, Jeff, that's really kind. Well, we've got our website, navarramedia.com. You can follow us on social media, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. I think YouTube's probably the best spot. You know, we do a daily show there at 6 p.m. Yeah. So, yeah.
Cool. Or you could just tune in just to have your blood boiled. It's good to feel alive, isn't it? Aaron Bastani, thanks very much for being on What Most People Think.
Cheers, Jeff.
Okay, that was the chat with Aaron Bastani there. So, you know, if you're interested in where he's coming from things and if you want to, you know, if you want to challenge your own view further, I mean, I'm not a Navarra media guy, but I do think when it comes to particularly looking at the Labour Party and stuff, it's interesting to have a range of opinions to draw on. Now, listen, with the podcast, if you leave it a 5-star review on iTunes, obviously, please leave 5-star reviews anywhere you can, whether it's fucking Podbean, Flick the Bean, fucking Spotify, Notify. There's probably a place called Notify. All that stuff. The ones I can access are on iTunes. So there's a really nice review here by Dre the Shadow. I can't read the whole one because it's long. I love the fact that there's a prompt paragraph. I think I've been listening from the first one, and this is essential listening. Comedians, the right sort of comedians, have become generals on the culture war front line. And many have paid the price in terms of their career. Fuck, I love this. This is so dramatic. Jeff shows why this is so by embodying eloquence, great communication, and an ability to see the human condition and point out its contradiction and flaws through the vehicle of humour. Fucking hell, mate. Do you want to give me a quote from my book? I love that. This is from Lorraine the Pain. Lorraine the Pain. Love this podcast. Has everything. Some of the guests I don't agree with, but will always listen, be prepared to think. Absolutely spellbound with the Dominic Frisby song brought tears to my eyes. This current episode, I love listening to all the cricket stuff. As a woman, hated when people label themselves, I love most sports, my husband doesn't. So I never get to chat about it with anyone. Felt like we were chatting with Jeff. This is from St. Bairstow. Okay, I get where this is coming from. This is clearly from an Aussie. I, Jeff Norcott, would like to make very clear that despite my recent comments, the reason England have lost 6 of the last 7 Ashes tests is that Australia clearly have better batters, better bowlers, a better wicketkeeper, and are much better at fielding. Well, this all made a lot more sense when you sent it on Wednesday of last week, didn't it, St. Bairstow, if that's your real name. I mean, I do think Australia overall probably are a bit stronger in every department. But I think that the Aussies are rattled. They're fucking rattled, aren't they? They weren't expecting it. They never expect it. They always look a bit shocked. I must say that. I mean, it's sort of probably why they win so much, the Australian cricket team. But when you see their post-match interviews when they've lost, they are they're fucking shell-shocked, aren't they? They start malfunctioning, don't they? Yeah, it's pretty ordinary, pretty ordinary. This is from Swifty5544. I thought I'd write a review for Jeff as I've been listening since lockdown and never got around to it. Now, if you wonder why I keep going on about stuff, this is why. People have busy lives. This guy has been listening to these since 2020, February of 2020, and he's finally got around to leaving a review. Oh, he wants his in a northern accent. Having grown up in industrial northwest and now relocated to Lake District, I know this is a Yorkshire accent, I feel Jeff's pain of hanging on to his working class roots whilst looking out my window at trees and fields and watching my children eat hummus, for fuck's sake. I mean, that was the most, you might not be a Yorkie, but that was probably the most Yorkie thing ever said. This is from Pop Cult 1997. Funny, self-deprecating show from one of the best stand-ups in Britain. Again, I'm fucking using these quotes, mate. And then the last new one says, I don't really do podcasts. This is from Casual Ken. Oh, he's Casual Ken, everybody. I don't really do podcasts. I'm a dinosaur, but my mate told me to listen to this, so I did. And it was good. I'll definitely listen again next week. I'm sure I saw Jeff and his wife walking through Covent Garden a couple of months ago when I went to see Lehman Trilogy at the theatre, but
could have been wrong. That was good as well, but it's finished now. Casual Ken. I love the way Casual Ken communicates. Like, in his review of my podcast, he went completely off topic and basically ended up with going, yeah, it was a very good play, actually. But sadly, it's finished its run now. But anyway, who knows? It might do a smaller run at some of the National Theatre things. Maybe Corn Exchanges, even. In fact, you know, some places.